WDIY Lehigh Valley Public Radio presents Lehigh Valley Discourse. Provocative, informative, and newsworthy, Lehigh Valley Discourse brings you the people and the issues that move and shape our region here on WDIY.
Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. We've been serving the Lehigh Valley for 25 years. I'm John Pierce, your host. If it's Thursday, 6 p.m., that means Lehigh Valley Discourse time. Our engineer this evening, James Johnson. Thank you, James. Our topic this evening is Christian history, and we're going to narrow that down and tell you exactly more about that, but it's a topic that is very interesting to me, and I hope to you too. My guest is Vanessa Romero, who is instructor of Christian history at Moravian Theological Seminary. So, Vanessa, I think this is your first time at WDIY, is that correct?
It is. Thanks for having me, John. Yeah,
it's a pleasure. Let's go way back to your origins, because one thing that I have always admired about you, and Vanessa and I go back probably 8 years or so, knowing each other from church, but one of the things that I've keyed in right away, because I'm interested in languages, is your master of English language, because you were not born here in the USA.
No, I was not.
Where were you born?
I was born in Normandy, France. And I've been in the United States for 19 years now. Mm-hmm. And I was not speaking English when I first arrived in the United States.
Very, very little English.
No, huh? Very little, high school level.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. And you arrived here in 2000?
Christmas 2001.
Hmm? So you started off with your studies in France, and you have a diploma from the Technical University in Information Communication. You studied book selling?
Book publishing.
Book publishing. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that interest of yours.
So I studied book publishing, but with an interest on the history of publishing. And so I did internship in archives in Normandy, actually. That was my second time. My first one was when I was 16, because that's my favorite place to be, is in archives, in vaults and in reading rooms.
From the age of 16?
From the age of 16.
Extraordinary.
I started my historical studies actually when I was 14, in history clubs and things like that.
You always knew that you were interested in history.
Yes, I always knew. Normandy is a place of history. As you know, very, very concentrated on World War II history,
right.
Obviously. But it's very medieval. The town where I was born in Lisieux is with houses dating back to the 12th, 13th century. Ah. So, yeah, history is, I was born in it.
You were born all surrounded by this medieval history.
Yes, and Catholic history mainly, so. But yes, I did concentration on book publishing, book selling. I worked in bookstores. My first job in the United States, I was actually working at a Barnes & Noble. So I became a store manager in a Barnes & Noble very quickly. I just love books. I love to be surrounded by them.
Right. Okay. A true student and a lifelong learner.
Yes.
Let's put it out there. Right,
yes.
Right from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then you made a pivot in your interest, your intellectual interest. It started off to be book publishing, and then you turned to church history. And you have a Master of Arts in Theological Studies with a concentration in church history. And you graduated with distinction, too, with some honors from Moravian Theological Seminary in Bethlehem. That was what year?
2018.
Your thesis was On Earth as It Is in Heaven, The Role of Evangelical Juvenile Literature in the American Republic from 1791 to the 1840s. So as a historian, obviously you love those old dates, and that was your master's thesis under Reverend Dr. Craig D. Atwood.
Yes.
Let's have a shout out for him, huh?
Yes.
He has been to our microphone here on Lehigh Valley Discourse.
A couple times.
So, yes, exactly. Oh, was that required listening
on
the part of his students?
No, but I listened to him anyway.
He's a great guy. So you're now into, how did you make this pivot from interest in book publishing to the history of Christianity?
Well, I was born and raised a Catholic, because in France we are not a Protestant country. But when I moved to the United States, all the people around me were Protestants. My daughter was baptized a Catholic, because that's all I knew, but it was not a great experience. But all the people I knew around me were Protestant, and they asked me to come to church with them. And so I join the Presbyterian Church.
Okay, now that's in this country.
That's in this country. You were here. Yes, we don't have many Protestant churches in France.
No.
But I became really, really interested in Protestant culture and the interaction between the American culture and the Protestant religion. And I just wanted to learn more, and especially regarding my own faith. So I did join the seminary. First of all, I did not have any particular vocation in mind, and I just started taking classes, and I just really hooked on the history ones, and I just focused on those. And my thesis is actually very concentrated on publishing, because I studied children's literature by studying actual books.
Now, when you say children's literature, does that mean religious literature?
Yes, because there was only religious literature during that period. The American Sunday School Union and were the only publishers.
And you're talking around the year 1800.
Yes.
So
there was no secular American publishers during that time.
That's interesting.
Yes, because the American copyright was just published around that time. So until then, all the books were imported from England. So until the American authorship turned around, the evangelical publishers were the only ones on the market.
Interesting. Now, your research focuses on the history of Christianity in the U.S.,
Yes.
With a particular interest in those decades that we mentioned, 1791 to the 1840s. Why the date 1791? Why is that a magic year?
It has a couple significance. One, it has to do a lot with copyright laws, because that's when American publishing could take off. It has a lot to do with publishing, because I'm looking a lot about the publishing history. I'm looking a lot about how children morality and religious education was formed. And during those years, the Republican ideas and evangelical ideas were so intermingled that you could not differentiate them. So I'm looking at the particular integration of both. And starting in the 1840s, that's when secular publishing took off, and you could differentiate them after that. And then religious books were not allowed in public school anymore. So that's why I'm looking at this particular era.
So before the 1840s, when you said publishing, everybody assumed it was religious topics that were being published.
They couldn't tell the difference, because they were just in the same books.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, is this only for children, or is this for children and adults?
I didn't look much at adults, but I'm also looking at prescription literature for mothers. And the same thing, you can't really tell the difference, because God's commands are the same as the Republicans' commands for mother. Take care of your children, because you're not the guardians of the morality of your children and the Republicans' ideas that we're trying to teach them. So they were both the same.
And let's tell our listeners that when you use the word Republican, you're not talking about the current
party. No, I'm
talking
of the Republic. I'm talking about the adjective of the Republic.
Correct. So this is an interesting insight into that I did not know about publishing starting off with such a religious bent to it. Your other area of historical interest, besides you started off with juvenile literature.
Yes.
Studying that. And then you have an interest also in Moravian history. And, of course, in the Lehigh Valley, the Moravians are super important. You've done extensive work on Comenius, and you were the first to translate Lux et Tenebris into English. All right, what is that? What is Lux et Tenebris?
It's a letter that Comenius wrote to Louis XIV. So Louis XIV, as we all know, he was not very nice. Protestants and especially Huguenots, which is my new area of research.
Right.
And Comenius, towards the end of his life, he was trying to convince Louis XIV to ease on the persecution. So he wrote him a very extensive letter.
All right.
And that letter was translated from the Latin into the French, but nobody's has ever translated into English.
Okay.
So now you
have done it.
Now I have done it, yeah. Right. Using both the Latin and the French translation.
And that was around the year of 1700?
No, 16... I'll have to double check, to be honest.
Okay, 17th century.
Yes.
17th century.
Yes.
Right.
It was towards the end of Comenius' life because he was living in exile in Amsterdam.
Uh-huh. And the community of Gracem Moravian Church, and you received a prize there, Memorial Prize in Moravian History. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So you're heavily into the history of Protestantism in the new United States, or relatively new. And you're also interested in cultural differences between the U.S. and France, particularly because you are French by origin. What can you tell us about how the development of books for children in religion shed, what kind of light does that shed on cultural aspects of the U.S.?
Well, I'm not yet very deep in the research on the French. What I'm looking at is mainly what happened right at the end of the 18th century when both nations were actually turning into nation states and how they took really two different directions. So like the United States, who claim, I'm going to use the expression loosely, separation of church and states, and actually became really a religious country. Like we are one of the Western country with the most religious diversity, but a really strong faith. Whereas France chose the separation of religious separation of church and state during the French Revolution, and we are now, I mean, during the 19th and 20th century, the church lost so much power, and 1911 was the official separation of church and state, and we're one of the least religious country in the world.
Now that's France.
That's France.
Correct.
So I'm interested in why those two directions.
Right.
When the church had so much power in France, and just why the two different shifts.
Well, of course, we're taught in the history books that one of the main reasons for Europeans to come to this continent was for religious freedom. And so that might be part of the answer there. Whereas France has this long history of, in the Middle Ages, domination by the Pope, the kings, and the clergy holding so much power. And so a lot of anti-clericalism goes on.
Definitely.
Yes, which we didn't experience in this country.
Correct.
To that extent, at least. My guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Vanessa Romero, who is instructor of Christian history at Moravian Theological Seminary here in Bethlehem. And we're looking at the way she has become interested in studying religion in the U.S., how she came to that interest. Vanessa, let's give a shout out to your family because you have a husband, Moises, and he is not French.
No, he was born in the United States, but he's Peruvian.
All right, Peruvian parents.
Peruvian parents. He was born in the U.S., but he spent his entire childhood in Peru, and he came back at the end of high school.
All right. Well, Moises, you better be listening right now. And then you have a daughter and a son.
Correct, yes.
Who are they?
So my daughter is 14. She just started high school. And my son is 11 and just started middle school. So,
Right here in the Lehigh Valley.
Correct, yeah.
And are they learning from home or are they going to be in school buildings?
So, I don't know. Right now the plan is 2 days at school, 3 days in online learning. So we'll see how long that lasts. Things are changing every day.
Right. And speaking of that, you also are teaching a course at Moravian Theological Seminary this semester.
Yes, online.
And it's online.
It's fully online, yes. Okay.
Have you done that before?
Not as an instructor, but as a student, yes. My last degree was completely online.
All right. Does that work out all right that we hear so many stories about, well, you don't get the same thing as if you were in the room with the classmates and the instructor? What's your take on that?
So I think it all depends on how the course is designed, and it all depends on the engagement of the instructor and the engagement of the students. So I looked at my enrollment. My class will be pretty small. So I think the engagement will be easier than if you had a class of 60 or 70.
Also, let's say that this is going to be a graduate course.
Correct.
So these students already have a bachelor's degree.
Yes.
And that makes a difference, too, because once you're in graduate school, you're much more applied, generally speaking, than before that. And so the seriousness, seriousness of purpose that students have as they become more mature is really important in this area, too.
What's really important with an online course is that you have to have different study skills. Time management, personal time management, is the number one reason why students fail an online course.
Interesting.
Work-life balance is the number one cause for failing an online course.
Right.
So that's something we will be working in that course, is building study skills as well.
Right. So that is a little bit of a warning to students who are going into online courses. Time for us to take a break now on Lehigh Valley Discourse, and I will be back in just a moment with Vanessa Romero.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
And welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. We've been serving the Lehigh Valley for 25 years. I'm John Pierce, your host. If it's Thursday, that means Lehigh Valley Discourse time. Our topic this evening is Christian history, and we're going to narrow that down and tell you exactly more about that. My guest is Vanessa Romero, who is instructor of Christian history at Moravian Theological Seminary. Vanessa Romero's interests are wide, as we will see as we go along with Lehigh Valley Discourse this evening. Her academic interests encompass the history of Christianity and the concept of collective memory and religious identity as people migrate and integrate new societies. That's an interesting statement. Collective memory and religious identity. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, each person has obviously an individual memory about where they've been, who they are. But there's also such a thing as a collective memory and who their community is, what their community represents to them, and what their collectivity means in the wider society. So my area of research right now, I'm studying, I'm going to say it in English for you, the Huguenots.
Well, that's all right. We would say Huguenots.
Okay, so I'm not even saying it right.
No, that is really, that is not kind to the French, is it?
No.
It's Huguenot.
Huguenot.
Where does that name come from?
At first, it was a pejorative term because they were not nicely seen from the start.
Right.
So they were rejected from the start. But what I'm looking at, so I'm working with Rye University in Amsterdam, preparing my dissertation proposal for my PhD, and I'm part of a research center who's looking at the importance of the shift of identity when communities are forced to migrate because of religious persecution. And my portion of the research will be to look at the Huguenots when they were forced to move to America, which is a very small portion. We're looking at 2,500 people.
You're saying of all... Now, the Huguenots were only in France?
At first. Yes. But then they were, because of the forced persecution and the revocation of the Edit de Nantes, and the revocation by Louis XIV, a lot of them fled France. So they went to England, they went to the Netherlands, and a very small portion escaped to the Americas and South Africa as well. But 2,500 arrived in North America, which is now the United States. Very few into Canada. So I'm looking at what happened to them a lot of studies have been made on what happened to them right away. They integrated themselves really fast. There was no more Huguenot congregation past 1730. They just disappeared. What I'm looking at is why they just reappeared in the 1870s. Why they just claimed a new identity. Why they integrated themselves into the history of martyrdom and the pilgrim history. In the 1870s, that's where American history was started to be written. That's when history became a discipline in universities. That's when historical research started. And then the Huguenots are like, well, we don't want to be left out. We want to be in the American history box.
Interesting.
So they're like, well, we want our history to be written. So that's when the identity started being written in history books.
And so you're saying that there's a period of about 140 years between the first Huguenots arriving in the U.S. and then suddenly reappearing in history books.
A period of 140 years where they disappeared. They arrived much earlier. During those 140 years, we just don't hear from them. So something happened to their records. Something happened to... Because they just reappeared. They claimed to be descendants of Huguenots. They're like, well, we have all this ancestry paperwork. We have their records. We have their sermons. So somebody must have kept all those records. Huguenot society is starting to pop up. So my role will be to find out what happened in that gap and who are these people that just claim all that ancestry and that heritage.
Right.
And why all of a sudden there's a new identity that's being created. And another thing is, like, were they really a persecution of the French, or did they come for economic opportunities, which certain scholars claim in the South, or
just be adventuresome?
Exactly. So
what reason? It's a little bit like the reasons for people going on the Great Crusades in the Middle Ages.
Yes.
How many of them were really interested in returning?
For theological reasons.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
For the religious
reasons.
So yes,
I'm really interested in the concept of identity and why people claim who they are.
And what you when you talk about the Huguenots that way, about their having a collective identity, it reminds me of Jews being persecuted, mm-hmm. being thrown out of this country and that country, and yet they continue to have an identity as a group.
Yeah.
And it's important to them. So you're interested in the 19th century, both in the United States and in France, and two different understandings of Christianity shaping the implementation and transmission of these ideals of the Republic and the emergence of two very different national ideologies. Let's go to the course that you are preparing, and well, that you're teaching right now at the Moravian Theological Seminary. It's called Women in the Christian Tradition.
But the course itself is the Christian Tradition.
The Christian Tradition is the course itself. Mm-hmm. Okay. And you're covering years 30 AD to 1500.
Up all the way till the Reformation, yes.
Okay. So 30 AD meaning?
Like we're teaching from the apostles to the Reformation. So it is a lot of material.
Yes, it is.
In
13 weeks. Mm-hmm. Well, we shall pray for you.
And for the students.
The Christian Tradition from the Apostles to the Reformers. I like the title. It's a lot of area to cover in a course.
And we have to make choices. We can teach it all.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So one of your foci is on women's leadership in the development of the Christian tradition.
Yes.
So why would you want to focus on women's leadership particularly?
Well, one of the reasons is women are often left out of the textbooks. I've chosen quite a few textbooks for them, and women are left out of textbooks. And so sometimes their names are mentioned in the textbooks, but they are rarely described as influentials. And I think for that reason, I think in those textbooks, the Christian history is incomplete. And I think by having my student work on women's history, women's Christian history, I'm completing it. So it's not like I want to teach two histories. I just want to teach I want to integrate both. So I want to teach it, but as in the context. I don't want to teach two different histories. A second reason is, for a long time, women's leadership, women's Christian leadership, has been taught inaccurately. And students need to know that it has been taught inaccurately. And just by knowing that, that's a fact of Christian history. The fact that some names had been changed, that's part of Christian history.
What do you mean names being
changed? Well, for example, like some feminine names, even of the scripture, became masculine names for centuries.
Oh.
So just that fact is part of Christian history. Just even in the scripture, women like were running churches, and in the Christian tradition, they became housekeepers or wife of leading citizens.
Oh.
So it was taught inaccurately. Another reason is that research in that field is progressing very rapidly. It's mainly female scholars. Some of them proclaim themselves very feminine. One of them is Mary Malone. Also, discoveries are being made in the bottom shelf of some archives, in private collections.
That's your favorite place to be.
That's my favorite place to be. some fabulous translators are passionate about what they find, and it's very important to keep up with the recent scholarship. One of the challenges of that era is it's very hard to find the primary sources because they haven't been kept or they haven't been preserved properly. Or if we find some, we have no idea who these women are. Because
you're talking about the Middle Ages. You're talking
about the first millennium, especially. Like, who are these women? Because records are seldomly kept unless she was a queen or she was the spouse of a king, or we don't know who these women are. So it's kind of hard. And another reason is because some denominations and even the Catholic Church are still debating the role of women in their own denomination, and like some women are still not ordained.
Right.
And by looking at the history, sometimes it just brings arguments to the dialogue.
Well, the ordination of women, which is a very serious thing for churches, it, to my mind, began in the 20th century. Does that sound right?
The women ordained?
Yes.
No, 19th century. The first
19th century.
In the United States, the first woman was ordained in 1853. It was Antoinette Brown. She was ordained. And even a few years after, some women were ordained, and their denomination actually rescinded it.
Oh.
But the first woman ordained was Antoinette Brown in middle of the 19th century.
Okay. But it takes then decades for more women to come forth and be ordained, and pretty soon you're into the 20th century for that.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing that comes to my mind is that in the Middle Ages, generally speaking, people did not sign what they wrote. You don't know who the authors were. And the authors, we can suppose, were basically men.
Yes.
It would not have been women who had the ability or
the education, the literacy level to do it.
Exactly.
Correct.
To do this writing. Mm-hmm. So now that we have more women studying, like yourself, we're getting more of an emphasis on women's role. Not only in religion, but in politics, as we have recently come to see with Joe Biden's nomination of Kamala Harris to be his running mate, and in so many other areas also, psychology. There's a courses are springing up, psychology of women, and so on. So there's a big emphasis. Women authors in from Latin America, for instance. Lots of emphasis
Definitely.
On that these days.
Just looking at a college catalog, and they're changing, and the focus on women, we can see right there.
Right. Mm-hmm. Women's studies
have
come to be in the last 20 or 30 years.
And they're not even called women's studies anymore. They break them down in so many different classes so they can study even on a deeper level.
Mm-hmm. We're going to continue this fascinating conversation after we take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm John Pierce. Glad to have you join us on Lehigh Valley Discourse.
Are you interested in inspiring and informing future generations through WDIY's programming? A gift through your will, retirement plan, or estate plan is a wonderful legacy to leave to those that will need a trusted place to hear what's going on in the world. For information about naming WDIY as a beneficiary, please call 610-694-8100 or visit wdiy.org/legacy.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture, from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Galicia, and Brittany, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Bringing you music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar every Thursday from 7 to 9 on WDIY.
And welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. I'm your host, John Pierce, and my guest is Vanessa Romero, who is filling us in on medieval history of the church and particularly women's roles. Do you see a pattern in how women's leadership role has progressed throughout this period that you're talking about? Now, when you say this era, you're talking about first century to 1500.
Yes.
So you're talking 15 centuries there.
Yeah.
So when I see the statement this era or that era, that is a long one.
That's a long era.
Yeah.
Yes. Well,
did the leadership role progress as
Yes, it did. It did progress, but very slowly. And it progressed, and I'm going to use an American expression, it progressed two steps forward, one step back. So women progressed two steps forward when they, I'm going to use a ecclesiastical men's expression, when they stepped out of their place, when their role got a lot closer to the equality that Jesus intended, as described in the gospel. And then they stepped, their role stepped back when the church, each time they needed to gain strength, and each time they created more institutionalization in their organization. Usually that's when, for social or political reason, or sometimes for misguided theological reason, they just needed to increase their institutionalization. And if you look at the Catholic Church and the very complicated hierarchical, that's one of the English words I don't get.
Hierarchical.
Yeah, you got it. Organization. So they didn't get there overnight. So every time the institutionalization built another step, women lost. So women at first, if you look in the scripture or in the first or two centuries, they were elders and presbyters and deaconess. Sometimes they were bishops. And those were ordained positions. And then they lost all that as they started building their institutions.
I imagine, Vanessa, that in your studies you've come across a specific woman or several that you find particularly inspiring during this time of the Middle Ages. Do you have an example or two?
So there's a couple, but one in particular really stood out for me, and it was a female English mystic writer. And her name was Julian of Norwich, so that's not her real name. We don't know what her real name was. Julian of Norwich was the actual church. She was an anchoress, and that's the church that she was. Her anchor was attached to.
What is an anchoress?
So an anchoress is a woman who lives in isolation, complete isolation. She has a little tiny cell attached to a church. And she gets secluded here. There's a rite that a bishop performs to seclude her there for the rest of her life.
Oh, my goodness.
So she lives in seclusion there for the rest of her life. She has a tiny window so she can participate in Mass. She can receive communions, and she can also give advice to people from the outside, supposed to be a very wise person and things like that.
So Vanessa is talking to us right now about a woman known as Julian of Norwich. The name Julian, J-U-L-I-A-N, that's a man's name.
Yes, that particular church was named after a saint. Okay. Called Julian.
Saint Julian.
Yes.
So that's the reason.
And since we don't know her name, they just called her after the church that okay. she was attached to.
Right.
Yes.
And you explained to us what an anchoress is.
Yes.
And her life.
That's the life she chose.
Life she chose. Okay. Mm-hmm. It was not imposed on her.
No, so that's the life she chose.
Okay.
Yes.
What kind of times did she live in?
So she lived in, we don't exactly know her date of birth and like the date of that she died. We think she was born around 1342 and she died sometime after 1416. So not fun times for England. It was a time of war. That was the middle of the Hundred Year War. Famine, the plague was pretty rampant. Mm. Norwich, which is where she lived, the statistics and the history books show that lost about one-third of its population and half of its clergy when she was a little girl.
Because of the plague?
Because of the plague. So it's easy to assume that she lost family members as a child, and she saw devastation and a lot of sadness and
heartbreak.
Pain and heartbreak, yes. So, yes, she lived in difficult times. Also, she lived in a time where women were still being accused of witchcraft because of the calamities that were affecting the country. So, yes. And also, it was a time where men leadership was crumbling. Kings were falling. The church was falling apart. That's the time of the Great Schism. So,
With the different popes?
Yes.
In Avignon and
yes.
And
so, it's very unstable time.
And she, there's a quote here, she was very smart and downplayed her own writing.
Yes.
And she says, but God forbids that you should say or assume that I am a teacher, for that is not and never was my intention, for I am a woman, ignorant, weak, and frail. That gives a flavor of that time and how women were supposed to think of themselves.
Yes. So it's hard to say if she did it to protect herself from the church, who say, well, I'm saying all these things because her writing is very theological. So she's saying a lot of things about God. She's even saying that Jesus is our mother. So it's very, she's stepping away from the Catholic Church. So by saying that she's a woman, please don't believe me. I'm not a teacher. Don't take my word for it. This is just... me, I'm a woman, so, you know, don't take my word for it. So either she's really, really humble or she's really, really smart. So that's one of the things I like about her.
And so she talked a lot about pain.
Yes, that's another thing I really related to her about. She talks a lot about pain, both physical and spiritual. I read her at a time in my life. It feels like it was very an opportune time. I read her within a few weeks of myself being diagnosed with a very painful and incurable like autoimmune disorder. And it was like her words were very soothing. She keeps reminding us throughout her entire writings that suffering is not a punishment and that we in our suffering we are never alone. She writes that, and I quote, God wishes us to know that he keeps us safe all the time, in joy and in sorrow, and that he loves us as much in sorrow as in joy. And sometimes a man, or a woman, I'm going to add, he's left to himself for the profit of his soul. So she was really soothing. I'm just going to add that she wrote this book, Showings, when she was 30, and she was extremely sick. And it was determined that she was probably not going to survive. That's when she had 16 what she called visions. And when she survived, then she wrote them all down. And that's what this book is about.
And she was only in her 30s when she died?
No, she was 30 when she was ill. And then she wrote this book after she recovered. She wrote this book and interpreted her visions about what she saw.
And she says, all will be well and every kind of thing will be well.
That's my mantra now.
that's your personal mantra.
Yes.
She's optimism with a capital O.
She gives, her writing is very hopeful.
Very hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And we could all use that.
And going way back to the 14th century.
Yes, 14 and early 15th.
And early 15th mm-hmm. century. So we never know how long our whatever we leave here on Earth is going to affect people long into the future. In her case, something that touched you very deeply from 600 years ago.
Yes, correct. So,
mm-hmm. Interesting.
It's one of the beauty of studying church history is you can be, it really affects you as a historian. And you can read text. This is one of the texts where I actually cried reading that text. And you get surprised by reading primary sources because you realize that the human condition, vulnerability is the same throughout the centuries. What you long for is the same. Humans don't change. And the answers we look for have always been there. Like we've always looked for something. And what you study in church history is the answers that people have come up with. It's the same all the time. Sometimes you relate to some of these answers.
Now, I'm interested in something you say here, that my passion for history is inherited from my growing up. Now, you described that to us as being surrounded by a town that has some buildings from the 12th, 13th centuries.
Yeah, we have pavers from Roman times.
Wow.
Which is very difficult when you learn how to drive.
What do you mean when you say a culture of devoir de mémoire?
So devoir de mémoire is we are taught that you have the duty to transmit the memory. You have the duty to transmit history. So it is never forgiven.
Forgotten.
I'm sorry. Yeah, so it is never forgotten. And it's everybody's duty to do it. And that's where we are. That's how I grew up with.
That is so different from my experience growing up in the United States. Never came across that concept that it is my duty to go. When you say that, I think of Native Americans, because they talk a lot about the importance of the river and the rocks and the mountains and what these natural features that they consider to be their ancestors. Mm. And so when the children come along, now the children have to be taught about these traditions. So you had the same kind of upbringing in France.
And I do a lot of genealogy because I do believe that my children should know who their ancestors are.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All of those of us who love history know that we need to know where we came from.
That's part of your identity.
Part of your identity, an important part. Mm-hmm. My guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Vanessa Romero, who is taking us through a long swath of history, the Middle Ages basically, talking about the traditions in the Christian church from 30 AD to the year 1500 or thereabouts, particularly the role of women. You're not just a student and teacher of church history, but you wear many other different hats. You're volunteer facilitator of reflection groups, being a mother that you mentioned your daughter and your son before, and you have special needs in the family too, mm-hmm. with the children.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And you've already revealed that you too have an illness, mm-hmm. that you have to take care of for the rest of your life.
Correct.
Right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Autoimmune.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that makes your optimism even more impressive, that you just keep going because that's what we have to do, right?
That's what we have to do, absolutely.
Now, flexibility in your schedule. Talk to us about that.
I color code everything on my planner. Yes, flexibility is key, but some parts obviously are not flexible. But for example, online learning is great. I just finished my last degree with online learning, which is something I could not have done. I did my last credits.
You mean you couldn't have done in person?
In person, yes.
Why not? Because of the virus?
But first of all, I could not have done it because my children's schedule would not have allowed me to.
Like, right.
I even wonder how I made it through seminary, honestly.
Where you, for the seminary courses, you actually went there
to
the campus.
I did. I went on campus. Yeah. And then they had nine courses, which was great. But my last degree, I had to do it online, and it was completely asynchronous, which was great. That means we don't have video conferences. It's at your own pace the whole time, which happened to be when my children stopped going to school because of the pandemic. So we had to homeschool at the same time. So at least they were kind of flexible as well. But yes, it was just because they have my son's on the autism spectrum, and but now he does his therapy through Zoom, obviously, because we just can't go anywhere. But he has like 6 hours of home therapy every week and OT on the outside, and he does hippotherapy.
I don't know about that.
Horseback therapy, which is fantastic for motor skills and sensory processing. So all that is crazy. You know, my daughter is now in high school, so I don't know what kind of, well, I guess now they won't have much after school programs, but, you know, you have to do bus schedules, and it's just crazy.
And so, you're talking about a 14-year-old and an 11-year-old.
Yes. But at least this year they're going to have the same school schedule, because last year they had two different start times. So it was just, yeah.
That's c'est la vie, huh?
C'est la vie.
The French have the perfect expression for it.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned before something that I think is really important too, and that is people who perhaps not by their choice. I would say, generally speaking, nobody would choose to have distance learning if you could go to a campus and be in a classroom.
I don't know about that.
No?
Mm-hmm.
All right. For you,
no,
it works.
I chose online learning because it's extremely convenient.
Okay.
It's just, for me, it worked for my schedule. It worked for my lifestyle. And you can create very meaningful connections. I connected very meaningfully with one of my professors, and we became really good friends, and we're still connecting now that I graduated. Like, you can create connection with students through discussion posts. You can figure out which ones you like, which ones you don't like. You can even figure out which one you can get help with on the outside. Collaborative learning works. I think it really depends on how well the course is designed from the start. I studied at Walden University, which is a university that specializes in online learning. So they have a lot of experience doing it, which is probably different from a university that's just switching just now. So,
well, I would guess that's part of your comfort level with distance learning, is that you did go through that experience at
yes.
Walden.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're right that when we have reluctance to think about distance learning, a lot of it is that we just haven't done it, that it's not what we're used to.
Mm-hmm.
And change is always difficult. And this is a time in our history when we have to
adapt.
Face that
mm-hmm.
and adapt.
And internet can be meaningful. I mean, I met my husband online. We're going to celebrate our 20th anniversary next year. So.
Oh, congratulations.
You never know.
So you met online.
Yes.
Did he approach you, or you approached him?
No, we met through a pen pal website.
Right.
And we just started chatting, and we chatted for several months.
Now, you were both in the U.S. at that point?
No, I was in France.
You were in France?
Mm-hmm.
He was in the U.S.?
Yes.
Okay. And you wound up in the U.S.?
And I wound up in the U.S. a year later.
A whole year later.
A whole year later, yeah.
Not very much time when we're talking about the Middle Ages.
No, that's true.
So, Vanessa Romero is someone who, I think, represents the American dream, in the sense that you came here as an immigrant, you have formed a family now, you have a profession, you have a master's degree going toward PhD, and let's repeat that the PhD is from Amsterdam.
Yes.
So, how did you find out about a university in Amsterdam to do your study?
Well, I looked into doing my PhD in the United States, and two reasons are holding me from doing it. One is extremely time consuming, it consumes everything, prevents you from even working. It would be so demanding that I could not take care of my children. I looked into several universities. There's nothing in this area for me. There's only three programs that I'm really looking into, and they are not in this area. It would require for me to move, which, considering my children's special needs, is not doable. The other reason is the way PhD programs are designed in the United States, yet they don't teach you to be a professor. They teach you to be a researcher. And that doesn't make you a good professor when you come out. And that's one of the other reasons that holds me.
Your goal eventually then is to teach, not necessarily to go back to those archives and
Alone. I want to do both. Yes.
Well, one of my professors in grad school said the most interesting class that you will teach is something about which you have written or at least researched.
But you don't always get that opportunity.
That's right. If you've done the research yourself, you know that subject from A to Z.
But knowing the subject doesn't necessarily make you a good teacher.
Correct.
Which is why I went to get a degree in college teaching.
I'm interested that you find a university that can do that for you in the Netherlands, ye olde Europe, as opposed to the U.S., where we have so much variety and so many possibilities here. Vanessa Romero, I thank you so much for coming to chat with us this evening.
Well, thank you for having me.
Believe it or not, our hour is up, and we have to move away from these microphones. But it's been a pleasure. I've been looking forward to it for a long time. So thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, listeners, for tuning in this evening for Lehigh Valley Discourse. Thanks to James Johnson for doing our board work. That means engineering. And keeping us on the air. I'm your host, John Pierce. Until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and it may be tax deductible. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7. WDIY is Lehigh Valley Public Radio. For more local news and information, public affairs, and links to NPR programs, visit our website, wdiy.org.
Connect with WDIY with our new app. Download for free from the Apple or Google Store and enjoy the great music, news, and programs you love on the go. The easy-to-use app is where you can listen to WDIY live or your favorite music shows on demand with our two-week archive feature. Download and share the WDIY app with your friends and family and introduce them to many choices, real voices.